This podcast is offered by Jikoji Zen Center on the web at jikoji.org. Our programs are made possible by donations from people like you.
So I'd like to make an exception, and since the Doan actually forgot his duties today, I'm the Doan, so we won't have the chant, but I would like to talk for a bit and talk generally about our practice and this session and what we're doing today. And then talk a little bit about some highlights from the Jewel Mirror Samadhi, both my take on it and what many other ancients, teachers have said in related contexts. And finally, we'll go, if we have time, we'll do what we should have done in the beginning, I think, or what I should have done in the beginning, is to just go line by line and look at each line or each zinger and see if we can understand it in some depth, but maybe not try to beat it to death to get the meaning out of it. Just look at it as a piece of poetry. So, this is the second day of Sesshin, the second full day of Sesshin, and we're barely, we're just getting into the Sesshin itself. In my experience, actually there's some 50 years of experience almost in this practice, maybe 45 in Jikoji Sesshins. So a lot of Sesshins, probably upwards of 100. And my experience generally is that the second and third day are the most torturous. They're really hard in some respects, and it can be light or very heavy, depending on the session. But I imagine most of you are suffering from aches and pains and sore knees, sore lower back, and some questions as to whether you can adjust your posture and move to a different sitting, and all those kinds of things that we go through to, particularly on the third day, I think. I've fortunately found a comfortable posture for myself, but my right leg hurts and my lower back hurts. And the spinal consciousness all the way up the spine and into the head and into the forebrain hurts also. But it's, you know, background, part of the background, foreground that we'll talk a little bit more about in terms of attention and concentration. But this session is a little bit different. It feels much lighter, not in the sense of not being serious, but lighter in the sense of being easy, on me at least, and joyful. I attribute that in part to Mark's Jukai this morning. It's a very joyous occasion. And also to all the careful preparation and work that we'll get around to the thank yous for at the last day of Sesshin. But I deeply appreciate all the work that's gone into this and is going into it. I'll say a special word for Andy, too, because I owe him a debt. The public address system that you're hearing me clearly on, and the microphone, the portable microphone that we can have a nice discipline in terms of our, if you want to comment, you're welcome to break in at any time, but you have to take the trouble to get the microphone so we know who's speaking, and then hold it close to your mouth so I can hear it, because otherwise my severe deafness is going to not work for me to at least respond to your thoughts. So thank you, Andy, for designing the system and for procuring it, getting it, all the components together, putting it together, and making it work. And thank you, Nico, for doing it. You can continue. So the 4 to 7 days of the Sesshin to me are more clearly described in terms of the line in the Jewel Mirror Samadhi that says wondrous. And it's hard to really characterize them fully, but they're the kind of sitting that you get where you don't want to quit necessarily. You know you will, you know you have to, you know that there's an end time, but it feels wonderful. That's you want to continue it forever. You want to be there forever. And there are jhanas associated with that, degrees of concentration, because we're settling down continuously as we go along. And it's actually cognitive or neurological reformation in your brain and throughout many of the levels of consciousness you have that's happening. Natural and wonderness, not delusion or enlightenment, or beyond delusion or enlightenment, according to serene and illuminating, also according to Jewel Mirror Samadhi. Silent illumination is the words in the, I think, the poem that Hanji, a follow-on, I think before Dogen, but after what's the author of this? Dongshin. Thank you. Mental blank. So the purpose of this talk and the purpose of our focus is really to encourage our practice in this session and in our lives. And my observation over 50 years is that it really benefits your relationships, it benefits all beings ultimately, because it helps you reform yourself, or to at least be aware of what you've done in the past and to some degree make amends and to try to avoid that in the future. It has a profound and somehow pervasive effect. I like the word cognitive reformation, and that's what's happening. But it's also, you know, that's a minor concept. And I'd like to read a little bit about that on page 4. Because that idea of neurology or the brain science is playing into this, and science in general supporting it. There was a recent workshop at Zen Center San Francisco, I think just either last weekend or the weekend before, that I really would have loved to have gone to. It was called Zazen and Neurology. And it was led by Paul Holler, one of the abbots of Zen Center. And part of their paragraph describing it was, as cognitive neuroscience develops a detailed understanding of the brain's mechanism, it offers new insights into the practice of Zazen in both seated stillness and in everyday activities. The innate capacity for open awareness and the disciplined development of sustained attention are both fundamental to Zazen and contribute to insightful and compassionate responses to our relationship and well-being. And it goes on to say, I'm not even sure that this is from the same quote, but it's true, so I'll read it. By abandoning our self-images as fixed centers of agency, we eliminate the stultifying effect of greed and hatred from egoism. Buddhists supply several arguments against the existence of an eternal, changeless, transcendental, and metaphysical self. That's also true of neurological science. They are very aware that we're walking around in a continuous illusion that I am I, and I am the agent, and I am doing this. And they're also aware that there's 10,000 factors that influence exactly what we're doing at every moment, including our genetic inheritance from millennia back in our family, our nurturing when we were children, our puberty, how we grew up, all the traumas that accumulate, what we know of therapy and psychology. But another way to look at this is in terms of Dogen's to study the way is to study the self. To study the self is to forget the self. So a modern comment on that is, this is the great relief of self-indifference, especially for those of us raised in where we were. The truth is that you aren't that big a deal. Isn't that wonderful? Well, let's see if that goes on. Well, I'm on other takes from modern sources. I wanted to mention four single words, buzzwords, if you will, but they're cute. They're from different abbots, and also from Brother David, who was a mentor of Koban and an early practitioner and supporter of Jikoji and of Tassajara, Zen Center in general. But his take is that gratitude in general, just appreciation, is the pathway to happiness. So just being grateful for our lives, and there's a TED Talk you can look up under Brother David Stendhal Ross, if you remember that, or just looking under happiness, where he develops that thesis in fair detail. Happiness is the knowing of our true nature. That's a quote from another abbot, whose name I'm not going to bring up, but he went on to say that joy is the knowing of our shared nature. So we know not only ourselves as individuals, we know ourselves as relational beings. And we are, that's one of the many, many influences on our actions and in our not being just the agents, the doer, the ego. Third one on joy. No, joy is the nature, I'm sorry, joy is the knowing of our shared nature. Love is the knowing of the connection, in the moment. Just sustaining that in relationship. So, some thoughts to bear forward. Going back a little bit to Wei Nang that we talked about yesterday in terms of light and mirror polishing as a reflection in terms of jewel mirror samadhi. He said to a further practice, he said, it is innate within you. And he mentioned commandment, as in the precepts this morning, tranquility, as in what we're doing and being and becoming, and practice and teaching. But he did it in a very non-secular way. Commandment, for example, is you will... it's innate within you that you will not want to kill and steal and use improper language and react to sexual things and dishonor people. That's not something that we're getting from the precepts. That's something that's innate in his mind. And I think, the detailed comments here, but he also said after that, you must, in every moment of your mind, realize your commandments by practice your own commandments, I guess would be better. Achieve your own recipe for finding your own tranquility. practice these truths, and finally teaching. And that's the most important one, the most difficult one. So teaching, passing on, transmitting. And that in every moment of your mind reminds me again of the mirror polishing, that Shen Shui is initially the two people who are contending in this poetry bash that we talked about. Shen Shui had a mirror that he wanted to keep bright. That was the mirror of the mind. Wei Nang said there was nothing from the very beginning. There's nothing to polish. But then he goes on to say, you must in every moment of your mind. So it's positive and negative as yesterday. It has it both ways. Does it? The pathway forward gets very confused because I'm trying to hit some of the highlights of the Jewel Mirror Samadhi in the way that's particularly relevant to us, but not to get completely bogged down in the line by line, which we'll do later if we have time. The ones that are most relevant to me are the Dharma of Suchness that Michael got into and Dean yesterday. The Dharma of Suchness, I once asked Angie, what is the Dharma? And she replied, it's just the truth. So there's your rules. It's what you will realize when you get to, when you realize your innate capacity through your own commandments, you get to the truth of understanding. And the suchness is, in Michael Newhall's term, reality. So the Dharma of Suchness is the truth of reality that gets passed forward from in intimate transmission. The transmission is, again, the loving connection, maybe. Local connection is another word if the intimate somehow hangs you up. And then the now you have it, preserve it well, again, is what we're trying to do. Keep it well. I think Dong Chan, one of his key lessons from his teacher Yun Men was this. When he was leaving his teacher, he asked him, how shall I describe you? Meaning, how shall I say what your teaching is, what your practice is, what your temple is? And Dong Shan said, or Yun Men said, just this is it. And that goes back to the Jewel Mirror Samadhi line a little bit. You are not it. It is completely you. So Yun Min's just this is it is his way of characterizing his teaching. I think the story is that Dong Chan went further on his travel and happened to pass this stream and looked down and saw his reflection, and suddenly it made more sense in the sense of his realizing that I am not it. It is completely me. The middle of the Jewel Mirror Samadhi. And with that, I'd like to go to page 4 to talk a little bit about, well, no, let's wait a little bit. First, I wanted to mention two more lines. The one that came to my mind in trying to rationalize this talk was Baba Wawa. Was anything said or not? It's totally confused and worthy of a baby, maybe. But also, like a fool, like an idiot, practice in secret, like a fool, like an idiot. And you feel a little bit like an idiot because, you know, how do we communicate? There are infinite things that we could communicate, infinite choices. These are some. So, in asking you are not it. It is completely you. Arises the question is both what is it and what are you? We talked a little bit about you earlier, and I'll go into that a little bit more in terms of Zazen and our reflections when sitting or our relaxation when sitting. What is it? Just this is it comes to mind. Science is hierarchy and interdependencies. Almost everything comes into reality. What are you? Whole being, body, brain, mind, consciousness, ego. All that is connected bodily, and it's the mind you think of as another separate, somewhat, entity from all the physiology that underlies it, but it's not. It is something that the brain is creating to try to portray as accurately as it can it. But also it reflects all of the influences from evolution and from your relationships and from your upbringing and so on. So what we can do during Zazen is to try to sort of identify those influences and relax them. And I have, a couple of pages from other sources. They're pretty close, if I can find them. The process that we usually think of is introspection. We look into our minds and we maybe see that passing thought, and we do a brief analysis of it and try to identify what is causing it and try to let it go. Try to say it's to let it pass, not cling to it. There's also the process of introspection, which is, I think, somewhat closer to what some of us are doing in Zazen. And it's looking at things that may be beyond words, but still very apparent. And the introspection little paragraph that amplifies that I printed out is, it's a sense of the internal state of the body, the sense of the body from within, perceptions and integration of all signals from within our body, whether we attend to them or not. Autonomous, hormonal, visceral, immunological, breathing, blood pressure, cardiac signals, temperature, digestion, elimination, thirst and hunger, sexual arousal, affective touch, itches, pleasures and pain. Interoception therefore lies at the core of our very sense of self. Physiological and mental life are dynamically coupled. The central and autonomous nervous systems, which are mostly unconscious, act on each other, higher cognition and emotional states interacting constantly. We sense, monitor, and adapt ourselves to the situation we find ourselves in, often without realizing it, embodied from infanthood, later in relation to others, through brain-body interaction. Brain and body are actually the same thing. Proprioception is another long term that's familiar to us, the sense of our dynamic muscular body in space. Homeostasis is another thing. We're actually tuning into the homeostasis within our body when we're in Zazen. We're seeing the movements and the waves and tides and all the things that are moving in order to keep us just functioning and upright. So we see a little glimpse, but most of that, almost all of it, is totally unconscious. There's a notion of allostasis that's part of these, where allostasis is more adjustment to change, whereas homeostasis is maintaining the constancy of your body. So you may have a transient in your body. There's a visceral reception, the perception of body or signals rising specifically from the viscera for the specification. The main point is that what are you is quite deep. It includes all of history, all of evolution, all of every moment as it has happened and is ongoing in your evolution. In this interception, another term for that is sort of a foreground, background attention. That's more what I wanted to share, that the attention itself, whether we're sitting or whether we're has some focus. Maybe it's on a body part, maybe it's on our hara or on our spinal consciousness or on our hurting knee. But there's a background, and that's in our consciousness also. So we have a lot of scientific work has gone into this, and it's very clear that we can influence you greatly through experiments that you're not even consciously aware of, through showing or flashing things or making changes in your environment that you don't even see, but your body knows it. And they can be tested afterwards. So this is part of what's being looked into body and consciousness, is to make that discernment of what's conscious and what's not. I guess the main point is that we're making steady progress into this from both a science and from a practice viewpoint, and that they're overlaid and mutually supportive to some degree. The background, foreground, I think the background is also Suzuki Roshi's big mind, if you're familiar with that term from his book, Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind. To complete my thought on Huai Nang, at all times, in every moment of your mind, you must purify your own mind, practice your own teachings, see your own Buddha by your own exercise, and reform yourself by your own commandments. Nice, but impossible, I think. Practice. There's a Milarepa had another set of six advices that I love, but might be better to try instead of continuing this. To make a few notes on sitting practice. Thing we need to keep in mind is that basic posture and trying to maintain our posture, trying to maintain mostly a straight spine and keep the lower part of the back in a little bit. The chin back a little bit, which helps to support the top spine and therefore straighten the spine. And with that, and with the attention to the foreground, but also noting the background and sort of merging the two, you can think of yourself as sort of an amoeba-like thing with maybe hair or tentacles going out to sensors, but the idea is that it shouldn't be stiff or pushed or this way, it should be sort of relaxed. And that upright posture and tension, breathing, and awareness of the background and merging is, I think, what Suzuki Roshi said was that you don't really need to reach for some special state of mind. You don't really have to try for some particular cognitive reformation in the process or wipe out particular things or some particular level of concentration. Instead, just sit. Just sitting is enough. Just yourself. This is enough. From various sources. So I think I will. I don't know how much time it is. It feels like I've taken no time at all, but...
Quarter till.
I'm sorry?
It's quarter till.
Oh, okay.
We have 30 minutes. We have 30 minutes.
Oh, okay, that's different. I think at this point I would be open to discussion. Yes, Mark.
Thank you so much, Cliff. There's about 12 points I want to ask you about. No, I won't try that. But you really covered a lot. And the two things that I picked out right from the start, because this is, as I understand it, discussion about thusness and the various possibilities for ways of understanding this experience of thusness in very poetic ways. But you started off by talking about how happiness has been studied to be the consequence of gratitude. And the way I'm pulling it together is this. It's actually a question for you because of your 50 years of experience in sitting with this. I can't tell you how much I value that. Is it possible that you can have an experience and an acceptance of thusness that does not include this, what seems to me to be a human... of gratitude. In other words, accepting things as they are, but not having to continually be grateful for everything. And I would define it like this. I don't mean totally not be grateful, but in the Buddhist sense of there's a relative and an absolute. In the relative sense, I'm very grateful for all of this. I'm very grateful for all the blessings that I have. But in an absolute sense, man, I feel like I've just been thrown into something that, for the most part, is unfair, full of suffering, and has no real... I mean, not something I would generally say, I'm so grateful so grateful that I was born. I don't see it like that. That would be an absolute view. But I do see relatively, I'm very grateful for all the wonderful things in my life. And so within that context, I guess what I'm asking is, do you think that it is possible to be happy with some level of, which I haven't attained obviously yet, some level of acceptance of thusness rather than this idea of gratitude?
Well, 12-point answer. Michael identified thusness as reality. And truth of reality, I think, is a logical consequence. I can't claim any expertise on thusness. But looking at science, I know very well that, you know, in terms of scientific terms, I know the quantum theory and how everything is interconnected and what all the influences are. And I also know that nobody knows what a quantum is. What is a state? What is the point? How can material occupy, what is mass? What is gravity? We know what it does, but we don't know what it is. I think maybe this is my personal take, but the teaching of suchness is something that we can transmit. The being of thusness, just this is it, is beyond my pay grade. I don't know. Happiness is, you should listen to Brother David's TED Talk. But I like better the definition that happiness is knowing of our true nature, original nature. Maybe potential would be a better word. Gratitude is something that will it is, as you say, it's what happens in your life naturally. It's not something that you push. I don't think.
Just a follow-up to your answer.
Could you hold it closer to your mouth?
Oh, just a follow-up to the exchange. I wanted to add to that that remember that the first line of the Jhulmir Samadhi says you already have it, or it's already existent. I think a lot of times when we talk about things like this, we always assume that they're something beyond us or to acquire or to gain. Or I actually think in most religious practice there's an innate tendency to project the so-called absolute outside of ourselves. And I think we do that innately when we talk about thusness or as it isness, we always assume it's something to get or to acquire. And yet right away at the very beginning the sutra says you have it, it's with you, you already have it. So just recognize and maintain and cherish and take care of what is already here. I'm really encouraged by that. But my question to you is...
Please do hold it really close, like a rock singer would hold it right up next to you.
Point. I didn't speak over that's it.
I'm not hearing you most of the time.
Can you hear me? Can you hear me?
Yeah, now I can if you speak.
My question is, in the context of the kind of main metaphor of the poem, you are not the jewel mirror. You are not looking in the jewel mirror. You're not it. It is completely you, or something like that. My question is, what is this it? Is it everything that's not you? Is it everything that's outside of you? How do you see it, this pronoun being applied to? What is it?
It's boundless, so it's not just you. But you're not bounded either. Beyond that, and it is reality, I think, as you teach you, that's this. So it is what you truly are, what you wholly are, and includes karma, if you will.
Could we call, from our perspective, could we call it like the world? You know, from our particular viewpoint, you know, being an embodied consciousness, could we say it's the world? If you're not it in the sense of, I understood it in the sense of, if you're not the center of attention, if you're not the main player, the main persona in your drama, then it being everything else is available to be you. Is that how you see it? Like, it's everything else besides you? Everything else that's not, that you presume to be not you, is actually available to be you? Is that how you see it? Does anyone have any ideas about what it is?
Thank you for the question. My our ego, how we understand ourselves, is absolutely vital and essential, and it's what we work with, but it changes from day to day, month to month, year to year, session to session, maybe even sitting to sitting. So that part of it can't understand what it is. I think it is, obviously it includes it, and it properly includes it. There's many other aspects of you that is it. I'm not sure I'm answering the question. Maybe you can... Yeah, I'm limited because I'm limited hearing, so you have to maybe take this discussion on yourselves.
Can you hear me, Cliff?
Yeah.
Oh, the mic is not.
There we go. I was just like, gosh, I think Mike just has one of those voices that disappears, and it's like, no, the mic wasn't on. Oh. I'm enjoying Mike's question, in all seriousness. I'm enjoying Mike's question of what is it? What is that pronoun referring to? And I just keep looking at all the times it's used, even to depict it in literary form, as to stain it with defilement. Though not appearing bright at midnight, well, we won't even go into that.
It's only available by contrast or something.
Yeah, that one is very interesting. During practice period, Norman Fisher was going over that one. Though appearing bright at midnight, it will not be noticed at dawn. Like, it's not obvious in the state, in the way that we normally think of things as obvious.
It's indistinguishable from just ordinary life.
Hmm.
Is that what you mean by not?
Well, yeah, in the ordinary or conventional, or what we usually think of as bright or in the daylight of what we usually see. That's kind of what I was thinking of. But when you, okay, so is it? What if we're talking about Buddha nature? What if we're talking about Tathagatagarbha? Is that what the it is? I'm just asking. It's
interesting because if I like these, I'll shut off again. I think the battery's going out. If we take that, I like that because I like Mike's question, because if I take that as an exercise, it's just an experiment. What if it is Buddha nature and then I read this like that? Or there might be another question somebody has and then I read this like that. It's like any other piece of poetry. You take something in mind and then read it with that in mind, with that contrast, and it changes shape or something shows up. Something comes to the foreground that wasn't there before, or maybe it was there, but it wasn't that obvious. That's all.
Is the battery failing? Is that?
Do we have that little pack of stuff?
What happens if you just hit the button again?
It'll turn back off because when it's low, it will be on for a while and then it'll turn off. Kathy?
I'm thinking of it in terms of a lack of something. It is what is left over when all the delusions are gone.
It is left over.
When all the projections in my mind are stripped away, then it is what's left.
I think it is the reality as we perceive it, as
not
we
reality,
human
reality,
right? I don't think it's the same it that they're referring to in terms of science, which would be the total interactions of all the quantum particles that make up you and your context and your background and so on.
But a couple of weeks ago, Jim was giving a talk about what we think about the stranger from a different culture or something like that. And she was pointing out, or the book was pointing out, that you can never know. We just don't know what's going on inside that other person. And yet, we jump to conclusions, I think, about a person or about whatever we're experiencing in reality. And I think those conclusions are generally mistaken. And maybe in 100 years, quanta will no longer be it. Who knows?
Oh. Anyway, I think I just well. It is just stripping away delusions, I think, that which would be like reality.
Yeah, yeah. I'm not sure that's possible entirely, but so I don't know that it's possible to humanly appreciate the totality of it.
Right.
But it's everything that you comprise, including past and present, space and time. Science would have no difficulty with that idea if they were able to write a big enough equation that would completely describe you, because it runs through space and time both ways. And the it may have the same kind of property. It's sort of a, but that brings to mind, that brings up the question of free will and all that sort of stuff. So it's very difficult. Mark? Or me?
So I was just thinking about clinging to it. Like, the more that I'm thinking about it and the group is talking about it, I feel some anxiety coming up. like, I want to know what the answer is. But, and I've only been practicing Buddhism and sitting for a couple of years, but all I can say is I feel, just since I've been practicing, that I really don't worry as much about finding it than I used to before I was sitting and practicing. I was constantly searching. I moved a million billion times looking for it and made a lot of changes in my life. And I don't know, it just seems like a lot of that has just vanished. And I don't know where it went. But I'm glad I don't have it as I'm glad I don't have it as much as I used to have it. What did he say?
Behind you, Mark.
I don't think I can top that. I feel like that was, I feel like that kind of that kind of nailed it. But I'm thank you, Cliff. I really appreciate you and your presence at Sushin and Ichikoji in the short time I've been practicing here. I kind of like Andy, I'm interested in this question of Tathagata Garba and kind of what Mike was saying, and it seems like this is the tension in throughout the evolution of Buddhist thought. It's like there's this radical negation, like with Nagarjuna, and but then this other turning of the wheel, and with Tathagata Garba, and people saying, "But wait, there is something, and it's incredibly special." But as soon as you try to like reach for it or say something about it, you can't say anything about it. But it's there, and you have to say something about it. And I don't know what the solution is, but this seems to be the central koan. You know, there is something that is no thing, and how do you express that or point to it? And it seems like a lot of the practice is just sitting down with that, being like, well, I don't know what else to do, so I'm just going to sit down and stare at the wall. But I also kind of wanted to offer a respectful counterpoint to the idea of that myself or awareness or consciousness reduces to brain states. And it seems like I'll have to dig it up and send it to you. There was an article by a cognitive scientist where he was drawing also on what he called fundamental physics and challenging the idea that brains are substantially real and that even brains are just another construct that are really compelling because they appear in four-dimensional space-time, you know, or three-dimensional, whatever, however we want to say that. But couldn't that in itself just be another construct or perspective or way of trying to understand our reality? It seems that in Buddhism, and especially in Zen, and especially with Dogen, that it's always pointing to like, and yet there's something beyond that, you know? So I don't know. That's not really a coherent question. It was just some thoughts I was having. So.
Did you have something?
I'm glad we brought, or focusing on the line, now you have it, preserve it well. Because the first time I worked with Dogen Zuji so I could teach it, I was drawn back to this line, now you have it. Because, and I tried to imagine how would Dogen strip that down. Because I knew, first of all, since he had this clear sense that we don't have Buddha nature, we are Buddha nature. So now you have it would have to become now you are it. And then what happens if you follow Dogen to the dropping off of self, body and mind? Now you've stripped it all the way down to now it is. Bam. And that's at the heart, I think, of that phrase. And, so that explains Mark's dilemma.
And it ties into all these Zen teachings about not chasing after it here, there, or anywhere. Where is it? Now. And now is it. Now it is, now is it. They're kind of this primal force of our reality. It's only right here. Everything else is just fabrication, conceptualization. Otherwise, now.
Well, yeah, Mike Dean, so in our discussions last week when I was having trouble understanding the difference between suchness and the absolute, and you said suchness was our experience of the absolute until we drop off the body and mind, and that's the difference between suchness and that. So is that kind of the same as that takes me to believe, so that it is the absolute, whether it is the absolute Buddha nature, no matter what name you give it, but it's...
Well, I think suchness, in my talk yesterday, we compared it to the fact that you don't see pure light. It's you only see objects because they're reflecting light. So you need them both. And that's suchness relative to the relative and the absolute. The way they're both contained in now, in just this. That's what allows us to actually see it or hear it or even think it as is. Whatever it is we're doing with it, it's because of that interaction. That the interaction of light and visible objects is a nice metaphor for that, I think.
I'd like to take a stab at it. So, you know, it comes back to, you know, why do we practice, and what occurs when we practice when we're sitting, and when we transcend our conscious mind, we're not aware of suchness or thusness or the absolute or the infinite. But we are aware of it when we come back, and the traces of that are left in our lives. I believe it's why we continue to come back to practice, because we actualize or realize our Buddha nature during our zazen, although we're not consciously aware of it. We're only aware of it. We can't speak of it because we don't experience it directly. But the indirect traces of it are that we are more flexible. We're less likely to look for it, as Mark said. We are more loving and compassionate and kind towards ourselves and towards others. And we have a positive impact on the world. So the traces of whatever it is appear to be benevolent and appear to be loving and kind and compassionate. So I don't know that we can describe thusness directly, but I think we can see what it does in our own lives.
I once picked up a hitchhiker who claimed he was Jesus. So you are not it. There are times where in an ecstatic state, there's a sense of, I am God. And to hear it that I am not it, but in truth, it is you, totally washes that away, where the entire universe is my support and makes me, and that feels complete, as opposed to I am it, and let me order all of you around because I'm it, instead of recognizing we're all it, and we can relax in it is us. The whole shebang is manifest here, and it doesn't go the other way. except in a minuscule amount. You know, a person can think deludedly that they've got it all, but it evaporates quickly.
Just passing it around.
Doug?
I want to get that one.
Okay, so a point that sticks out to me is when we refer to it, it's usually something that's separate from us, versus thusness kind of suggests a beingness. So if you have a mirror, it's reflecting something that isn't the mirror that's reflecting itself, you know, or is the mirror, you know, if something's looking at itself in the mirror, it's reflecting back what is looking into the mirror. You know, so if you're seeing war and woundedness and hurt and pain, is that actually what you're seeing it, or is it a reflection of what's actually the beingness that's separating itself out so that it can be seen? And if it's seen, can it be reintegrated instead of being an it that's projected outward into be it? You know, we had that old scene with Nike, just do it. You know, what if we, instead of projecting it, what if we be with it, we sit with it? Maybe it integrates, maybe it doesn't, but the slowing down of it and projecting it out to observe, maybe that's part of the process. You know, all of these things in here are things of separation. It's not about wholeness or integration. Maybe towards the end of the song where it's, you know, just continue in this way. It's called the host in the host. It's, you know, what the host is projecting, whatever it is that it's seeing outside of itself. And if you can be grateful or in gratitude about even the hard things to look at, maybe that's a way to be with it, to be it, rather than to cast it out.
I'm thinking of the word thusness. I'm assuming it refers to. I'm assuming it refers to, or it's based on the word thus, which I think is worth thinking about, because thus would be used in a context of you have, let's say, an A statement, thus B. So there's a therefore aspect. There's a contingency or a continuation or a summation or a subsequent emergence in the sense of thus or therefore-ness. Perhaps can thusness be slightly translated as therefore-ness, a sense of therefore. So you have a sense of an ongoing chain of, production and...
That's like karma.
Yes, it's like karma. I'm not sure if there's any real point I'm making here, but just trying to bring it back down to the sense of what does thus mean? Thus means it pushes you forward from one set to a subsequent set, which also seems to have something to do with, perhaps I'm just taking these words quite literally, but you have a mirror which can reflect back and forth. You have jewels which refract and reflect, so they keep bouncing back and forth, and they continuously therefore each other, or they thus each other.
Confirm.
They confirm each other, yeah.
Yep.
So, yet they also slightly modify each other, because if there wasn't some change between the two, there'd be no reason to mention it, really. Mm-hmm. So there's a, it just kind of gets to the sense of just a spinning in on itself and an out from itself. I was wondering yesterday if, I never really thought about the words refract and in connection to reflect, and it occurred to me to wonder or to ask if reflect is to refract as perhaps centripetal force is to, now I'm totally lost, what's the opposite, centrifugal force.
Centripetal.
Sorry?
Centripetal.
I'm sorry?
Centripetal.
Yes, my mouth is not working well today, but it's just the back and forthness between states of emergence, really, or something like that. But I'll stop there. Thank you.
Just to clarify the term, in translation, it's translated as thusness sometimes. It's also translated as suchness, which has more of a connection with as it is-ness, you know? The Sanskrit terms, bhutatva, is a kind of, it has a broader meaning. It means the unfabricated function, the unfabricated functioning of reality as it is. So it's before, or I don't like the word beyond, but it's, let's say, before any mental fabrication or assumption of its having meaning or identity. It's the doingness of reality. That's bhutata or yatnam bhutata. That's the original Sanskrit term. So the thusness, suchness, as it isness, they're all kind of used. They're kind of used together. Yeah, it's some kind of essence maybe, or unfabricatedness.
Or unmodulated, perhaps. It's not altered by a reception or a perception that then needs to be expressed. So it's pre-expressive.
However, the minute we start to talk about it escapes.
Is it like energy vectors? Energy vectors.
Energy what?
It's an energy vector. Basically.
What's the second word you're saying?
Vector. Like dynamic. It's an energy vector. Dynamic. That energy is, it is a vector, it is a movement, it changes, it affects, it doesn't discriminate one way or another, it just is.
It's a functioning. It's a kind of functioning.
Functions tend to be more mathematical, because functions usually have some constraints. Energy vectors are dynamic, they just are. You're a dynamic, you are an energy vector. As far as I'm concerned, in your mind head. Well, that's the way I think of that, because you are basically all just dynamics. You're not a static, you're a dynamic. So, energy vectors. You're an energy vector.
So,
what?
So, I do too.
Because we were looking at the seeds, consciousness seeds, and how when you don't have assumptions about them, they are. They just are. You are. And the way in which you manifest your life is how you have assumed your energy vectors are. created. You're making choices, and that is your pattern of history and choices and things. And you can change those, but it takes work. You know, you get kind of into those little habit things. Kind of hard. So, yeah, energy vector. Cool.
Stop. Good.
Sorry?
Is it somehow connected to a configuration of energy flows? They just assemble.
I think there's a danger that we're getting lost in different semantics as well as, you know, different meanings associated with different words. But also, I wanted to mention a couple of things. One is that there's also a danger of recursion in getting into these thoughts. And so the thoughts go round and round, and you can have a thought call itself, and it generates, it perpetuates forever. So we want to watch for that in our practice. And also, in defense of any implied attack on science or doubts on science, scientists themselves, I'm sure, are as varied, and many of them have this deep underlying faith in whatever beneficial factor is involved in their work, so that they see, some of them are into different aspects of different religions and so on, but it's not, their science is not inconsistent with that, with those kinds of beliefs. So I think that they too are looking. Yes?
Isn't science just looking for it, like we are?
Okay, I'm ready to quit on that. So anything else urgent, or how's our time? I think it's probably...
It's time. It's time for...
It's time.
Thank you for listening to this podcast offered by Jokoji Zen Center. Our Dharma talks are offered free of charge, and this is made possible by the donations we receive. Your support helps us to continue to offer the Dharma. For more information about Jokoji, please visit us on the web at jokoji.org.